All right.
So I changed the title on this to How the West Was Won. I think initially in the syllabus it was something like East and West Divide. There's not much left to say about East and West Divide except the final thing. It'll be important. But really, all the cracks are already there, going all the way back to the 6th century, even before that in a sense. But the church was liberating the West. This is the big idea. I'll hit you with this big idea right up from the front, because this is a paradox in the true sense of that word. The church was liberating the West, namely Western civilization, politically, even while at the same time, that same church was enslaving the faith in political chains. So let me repeat that. At the same time, in the high Middle Ages, 10th through 13th century, the church was liberating the West politically, while the same church was enslaving the faith in political chains. Now, you ought to be used to such paradoxes by now. And by the way, a paradox is an apparent contradiction. It's not an actual contradiction. It just strikes us as weird that both of those things could happen in the same historic stage by the same players. So how was this the case about this era that became known as the High Middle Ages in Europe? Well, Charlemagne's notion of the city of God was doomed to failure from the beginning. We looked at that last time. The court of Charlemagne actually concocted a plan for him to marry the Eastern Empress Irene. But they didn't go for it. She didn't go for it. And so it failed. And so Leo's anointing and crown of Charlemagne in 800 would have to do. There's a bunch of forged documents at this time. One of them was the Donation of Constantine, granting the Pope universal authority. And there were other things that happened at that time that did not endear the East to the West. There were fights over Central European mission fields. There was the addition of the, well, this is going to feature prominently, but it's by no means the main thing that split them apart, this clause. Filioque, it just means, and the son. How could something like that be something that splits an empire? My goodness, that's the criticism that modernists would throw to that. But the East was not happy about that addition. And then there was also the cumulative effect of all these different things that really annihilated the chance of the East and the West getting back together. Charles's surviving son, Louis the Pious, they always had to have like a mob name, the Pious or the Bald or something like that. He was Louis the Pious. 814 to 840 was his reign. He was ineffectual, and when his petty three sons divided the empire into three in the Treaty of Verdun in 843, the split marks the beginning of the permanent borders between France, Germany, and Switzerland. So a lot of stuff that's going on right now, if this was a regular history class and not a church history class, we'd talk about the rise of nationalism. But that's just something to keep in mind. Nations did not exist as they do today. Nation states with really, really definable, recognized borders. That's something that was developing during the late Middle Ages. But this division of the sons of Louis made for a vacuum of armed resistance to three external forces that really kept Europeans huddled in a cell of anarchy and uncertainty in Europe. So the Moors were coming in from the south, the Vikings from the north, and a third group from the east called the Magyars. So in a sense, it's a second wave of barbarians. Let me take that off for now. A second wave of barbarians at this time. Next to that one that happened back in the 4th century, in the 5th century. Christendom was surrounded and shaken to the core, if there was a core. And the son who took control of modern France, Charles, here he is, the man, the legend, Charles the Bald. Yes, indeed. His dates were 843 to 877. I mean, they didn't have last names. They could say the mom and the dad thinking through this, and it's either Charles the Bald or, you know, William the Wench, or, you know, what am I going to go with here? I go, well, he's bald. Let's go with that. Well, Charles discovered a thinker who was more than Alcuin's equal. You remember him from Charlemagne's court. And he really carried on, and he was one of the few people to carry on this vision of this intellectual revolution. And his name was John, and he goes by a lot of different names. John the Scot, although there's two John the Scots in philosophical history, so we're not going to put that. His Latin that you always hear him refer to by the philosophers, John Scotus Duns, or his regular last name, I don't know how to pronounce it, Eregena. But like I always say, I don't think anybody else does either, so I'm going with it. John Regina. His most famous and controversial work was a philosophical treatise called On the Division of Nature. It was Neoplatonic, borrowed from the philosophy of Plato, and honestly, it was too sophisticated for anybody in that age to criticize. Although if they did, they were looking at it, they would have found some things to criticize. He knew his Greek, unlike a lot of other people at that time, and so he translated a few of their works into Latin. There was an increased attention in his writings to the doctrines of good and evil, what distinguishes those, and predestination, and also a renewed study of Augustine. So he learned his Plato in a lot of ways through Augustine, and so a lot of people started to take Augustine's writings more seriously at that time, whereas they had not before. So he's writing in the mid-9th century, during a time when intellectualism, so what Charlemagne launched really only lasted for a generation or two. There was really a dawn of a second Dark Ages right after that. But John had a complete system, borrowing from a lot of different ancient writers, like Gregory of Nyssa, as much as he did from Plato. His basic concept was this concept of nature. He didn't use the specific word that the theologians used in their controversies in the 4th and 5th century. He used the most basic word, which is natura in the Latin and physis in the Greek. It's where we get the words nature and physics. And so for him, there was one thing that he was treating as nature. And this is, if you're interested in philosophy at all, we're going to see it with Aquinas and his natural theology. A lot of what bothers anti-intellectual types, even in very rigorous schools like presuppositionalism in the modern world, is they don't like the idea of, for example, calling God a thing. Let's capitalize that. Even if he's the, you know, the ultimate thing, the supreme being, sometimes we call him. And then this piece of chalk, for example, a thing. That makes God and this piece of chalk two members of the same class. What will happen to our understanding of God if we're thinking about it like that? So, in John's mind, nature came to mean the whole thing. At least that's the way he's often interpreted. So, it looks a little pantheistic at first. It looks a little monistic. So you have the idea that Plotinus and the Neoplatonists had, that God is like the one, and everything else is sort of this emanation from him. And that's what happens when you do natural theology. In other words, when you think about God through unaided reason, outside of revelation. Those are the sort of criticisms on the surface that you always hear. Now, it's more likely that in his meaning, there was a rough division, as the title suggests, the division of nature, into two totally different things, two totally different kinds of things, the creator and the created. And that, again, is something that irks a lot of theologians about natural theology, some kind of reduction of God to the categories of human reason, as in analogical words like things or nature. John the Scot, as he's otherwise known, at least gave comprehensive beginnings to the medieval natural theology, beyond the works of Augustine. That's why he's important. But aside from Scotus Duns, there's really not a whole lot of profound theological, or at least innovative thinking going on at this time. And so what happens is, something what might legitimately be called a second Dark Ages emerges from the late 9th to the dawn of the 11th century. You have this in your notes, the two different things that, you know, I made up. I really drew this out in the last couple of weeks, how the myth of the Dark Ages really covers everything from the fall of Rome, if not the legalization of Christianity, all the way till the Enlightenment. That's usually what people mean by the Dark Ages. But let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's an important sense in which there was a darkness that's brought about by barbarian invasions. So if you want to give it exact dates, you could place the first darkness between 455 and 782. Why those particular dates? Well, one is the sack of Rome, and one is the arrival of Alcuin at Charlemagne's court and the beginning of that intellectualism. And so you have this sort of extinguishing of this light over here by these barbarian invasions. In other words, Christian culture had not turned the lights off. It was expanding and expanding classical thought in a Christian conception. And then here you have this explosion from nothing where there was darkness beforehand. And the same thing you see after that. The second Dark Ages you could place roughly at 843. You remember that fracturing Treaty of Verdun that I just mentioned, where those three sons split up the empire. There's barbarians coming in, and typically when somebody's chasing you with a spear, you don't have a whole lot of time to write books and think about stuff. And so that's what I was going on there. And you can extend that to the year 999, which is the beginning of a papacy that we're going to talk about in a little bit, Sylvester II. He launched another sort of intellectual revolution. These dates are somewhat subjective, but they're much more objective than to simply broad brush the whole era as equally dark, because there's a lot of suggestions there. So what's the value of suggesting that there was any ascent out of darkness when it only lasted for a single generation? Notice that the time in between this is very small. When Charlemagne launched this out versus when this empire was split apart and those barbarians came in and there was a decline in intellectual output. What is the point even mentioning that if it was such a short amount of time? Well, the answer is that bringing light out of darkness is always a rough ascent for human beings. It takes a moment to destroy something. If you have toddlers, you know that. It takes a moment, a single moment, to bring chaos, but it takes generations of careful meditation to build something. It's always much more intellectually rigorous to get something right and do something right and do something that lasts, and it's always very, very, very easy to attach yourself to something evil. That has a lot to do with the evil in our hearts. We're much more attracted to disordering ideas. And it has to do with our finite minds. If you combine a finite mind with two little beady eyeballs in a big world with sin in our hearts, that's two strikes. And it's a lot easier to gravitate to chaotic, disordering ideas than it does ideas that sustain things. It's a thankless persuasion to uphold things, to preserve things, to conserve things. That's why this is important. It's important for theology, it's important for culture, and a bunch of other things. A lot of things going on in the church at this time. The doctrine of the Lord's Supper and the Mass and transubstantiation are developing more and more. That was already there way back in the 4th century, the Lord's Supper. But the idea of the Mass, I think I mentioned this in a previous week at that time around Constantine and all that stuff. That word, by the way, comes from the Latin word missio, which means to send or sending. And so at the end of the Mass, literally in the Latin, et missa est would be go, it is the sending. And the central event, the central thing, which by the way, the relic in a weird sort of way, it's not going to take the place of this, but it's going to be a second. In a sense, I'm surprised that the Catholic Church didn't make relics in an eighth sacrament of the church, because the way it was being used was this sort of meteor. Yeah, I was thinking of Islam, how that black stone fell in the Mecca, and it became this object of worship even still in Islam. Well, the same sort of thing was happening with relics in the Catholic tradition. There was an evolution in the church's theology of miracles from Gregory the Great at the end of the 6th century to the 8th and 9th century. The relics were kind of this magical shard from beyond. Whether it was in the form, usually it was in the form of the bones of some dead saint. But why was this happening? Is this happening because the church is introducing some alien thought? Because the church is entertaining some alien pagan thought? Well, there certainly was a pagan infiltration. But this is not something that bursts onto the scene because Catholic thinkers are thinking too much about stuff. Just the opposite. It's something that already exists in the pagan culture for centuries, and it was difficult to uproot the idea. What is the chalk today? It's like an inferior eraser. It's got to be a whiteboard eraser, because it's not coming off. Anyway, so you have this paganism, this pagan view of supernature, and one thing that the ancient pagans and the medieval pagans had in common was that nature, in a sense, was bigger than supernature. Doesn't that violate the very meaning of the terms? Well, not for them. Because any gods or other spirits were localized. They were in the house, so to speak. And that was something that they really didn't shake from their idea, from their worldview. That biblical category of supernature, meaning super, above and beyond, transcendent to nature, really hadn't shaken people. So you get superstition when you see natural things, changeable things, moving things, as more ultimate than invisible things. You get superstition, whether it's in the modern suburbs or in some ancient pagan temple. So evil is still out there. It's an infection. It's something that presses in on me from out there. If anything, I'm the solution. That's the problem out there. So in this sense, Christianity was uniquely supernatural in the ancient world, transcending both the ancient view of projected supernature in Greek materialism and the local supernature of many early medieval Christians. Yet both the ancient pagans and the medieval pagans, who were these genuine Christians, and they don't hear that the wrong way, it's just in their worldview and their thinking, they had not matured beyond ancient paganism. Local supernature. That's why they baptized on deathbeds and got you wet to expel a demon. Supernature was localized. Their problem was not that they believed in a demon-haunted world. Their problem was they thought that they haunted you from a locale, from a point. If I've got a demon in my finger, it makes a lot of sense to chop my finger off. But if a demon isn't a local thing. So the relic played into this whole idea here. The relic really couldn't be ignored by those whose conscience could abide by it. Often it was attached to the altar, which was the location of the Lord's table, which, by the way, was already kept apart from the body of Christ by that screen with the icons on it. The relic was an explicit mediator, even if it wasn't a person. It was the means of communication for those most holy persons beyond the grave. And it became a political object. You remember, even if you don't know your Bible, if you've ever watched the Indiana Jones movies, remember that first one, Raiders of the Lost Ark? And do you remember the way that the Nazis, as they did in Samuel, the pagans initially, when they got the Ark, they thought, hey, we're going to kick some people's butt here. We've got a powerful object. The gods are going to bless us and so on. And then in the case of the Bible, they eventually didn't want the Ark. They wanted to give it back to Israel. It was bad luck. But that's the whole thing that you saw in that movie, is that the Nazis wanted to find the Ark so that they can take over the world. They would have that power in front of them. Well, the relic was functioning a lot like that, a political object. The best relics gave people a certain centrality, politically, and authority. So, as one example, both the Abbey of Fleury and the one at Monte Cassino claimed to have the bones of Saint Benedict. And they weren't claiming to have, like, an arm and you've got the leg. They were both claiming to have the whole skeleton. So to possess these bones, these relics, gave the monastery a right of centrality and decision-making in the eyes of the people. When did all of this get started? Well, in the 4th century, the mother of Constantine, Helena, claimed to have found the very cross upon which Jesus was crucified. This after sending a team of proto-archaeologists to the Holy Land. She even claimed to have dropped one of the nails of the cross into the Adriatic Sea so as to calm a storm. But this was only the beginning. By the end of the millennium, at Reading Abbey in Surrey, England, we know that there was 242 relics. And if you just survey the list of the relics were at some of these places, you immediately want to consign the entire medieval civilization to their version of the theater of the absurd. And really, everybody kind of had to go along with this to some degree, even if you thought it was absurd. But from a Christian perspective, we can see that same power of the demonic, the sway of the kingdom of darkness over these perfectly normal people. What were some of these relics? Well, there was one shoe of Christ's, his swaddling cloth, and even if you could believe it, a container of the blood and water that poured from his side on the cross. There was even bread from the feeding of the 5,000 that had managed to avoid molding. But, of course, a miracle is a miracle, so a little mold preservation was probably not a big thing. What else can we say about the church at this point? You know, we're hitting all these high points, all these different borders and armies and, you know, big figures. What was the actual local church like at this time? It's a local church in Europe that's congregating in the midst of what would become a Muslim majority outside. Beyond these borders, inside of which the Islamic was civilized, and further west, you were uncivilized. You were striving for light out of darkness. The West is undoubtedly more barbarous in external conditions than the East at this point, by the 9th, 10th century. The Christian on the frontiers of southern Europe and further north among the Germanic territories is worshiping in a den of superstition. It's the dawn of the 9th century, you remember, it's after Charlemagne, but it's not as though nobody's acting according to conscience. For example, in the decade of the 850s, the church in the infant Bulgaria. So Bulgaria as a nation is starting to come together. And it was deciding whether it wanted to adopt Frankish or Eastern thought and liturgy. And they opted for the West, but the threatening armies of Constantinople forced the hand of their ruler, Boris I, in the other direction. So you have a whole nation of people that are deciding to worship like the Franks did, not like the out east, and yet the emperor comes in and changes all that, squashes that. And now what shows that their real faith was operating was that the nobles of the land, not just the peasants, but the nobles of the land revolted essentially for their freedom of conscience. They were put down, but the point is that they acted according to conscience nonetheless. So one thing you don't want to do, you don't want to have in your mind that for 15 centuries, or at least for 12, from Constantine to the Reformation, there was no real Christians, there was no acts of heroism, there was no bucking these trends, there was no criticism against the church or anything like that. That's simply not true and not helpful, and you don't need to argue that in order to say that, by and large, there was a corruption going on. You had innovations in music. If you're interested in that at all, there was the polyphonic form that had emerged. Here's another, it's just another cultural advance of the West in the Middle Ages. You're going to keep seeing this again and again. Technology, the rise of capitalism, medicine, the rise of the university, we'll cover that in 2 weeks. Methods of warfare, we'll cover that next week. All these things that you think emerged in the Enlightenment, or at least maybe in the scientific revolution, all emerged in the Middle Ages, usually in monasteries, and places like that. Up until that point, you had this monophonic, single-tone voice, and not an erratic kind like you do in contemporary worship. We've regressed from that. But you had this harmonization of voices that really, and you had a science of it. So you see, we don't know when it emerged, but you see in the year 900 these two treatises on music that develops this. And it wasn't the first written. Augustine had written a treatise on music and the formal structure of it. But then you had instruments developed to match that complexity, the pipe organ, the harpsichord, the violin. And so you can study that out, and you can see how there's a thoughtful, careful development of the form of music at that time coming from the church. Congregations recited the Apostles' Creed and the Lord's Prayer from memory, and it's at exactly this time, 9th through 11th century, that marriage started to be considered a sacrament of the church, as the church assumed to itself the power not only to officiate, but to annul a marriage that never happened, as divorce per se was now disallowed under any circumstance. Following some of Augustine's thoughts on sexuality, some of which were taken out of context, most of them usually are taken out of context, the priests would be celibate for the express purpose of setting up that ultimate distinction between the clergy and laity. So the one of the main points of priestly celibacy was to further divide, or at least complete the division between clergy and laity. One of the most important things that they had over the laity was their purity. And one of the main expressions of purity was in the realm of sexuality. So in the 12th century, England's a holdout here. England really, it's not until the 13th century that there was a final authoritative stamp from the Roman Church. We'll see that. I think it's the Third Lateran Council that actually, as the 12th century, that makes priestly celibacy mandatory. Somebody asked the question a couple of weeks ago, were there any priests still married at this point? Yes, and especially in England. They really resisted that trend until the very end. So by this time that the church is worshiping in this way, and it's very complex, much more real than we tend to look back on it, it's at this time that the Muslims are really pouring in, not just to Spain and not just from the East, but the Moors actually took over the island of Sicily in 878. They had already momentarily sacked Rome in 846. So keep those things in mind as we come to next week and you see the beginnings of the Crusades. Bear that in mind. So by this time, namely the 10th century, we're going to start referring to the territories of Europe by their modern national names. I'm not going to talk about Burgundia. I think I'm going to mention them once. But I'll start saying Germany and France, no longer Frankland or Francia or the Franks or any of that stuff. So we'll just use the names that would develop in the nation states anyway, for the sake of simplicity. The distinction is not as much importance in church history as it would be in history as a whole. So we're going to universally now speak of England, France, Spain, Italy, Germany, Switzerland, and so forth, even though the borders are not universally recognized quite yet. Any questions before I get to this light coming through in the early medieval times and feudalism. Any questions at all about that intro material? It's kind of a long introduction. All right. Two extreme views. Listen to this. Worldview shaping stuff right here, stuff that you're reading right now maybe. Two extreme views that you want to avoid, that you don't need, that you'll probably be pulled at one point or another, your brain will be pulled in one direction or another. Two extreme views usually taken by Christian commentators of all stripes, but which are very misleading about something that actually matters a great deal. One extreme, and by the way, both appeal to me. If my brain is feeling one way or the other, my brain feels sometimes attracted to some ideas versus another, appealing thoughts. And so I can see myself going in both directions. The worldview part of me, the gospel part of me, as if those are two different things. That's my check. That's my reminder. So one extreme is to assume that the liberating aspects of the Christian worldview, which are superior to Renaissance humanism, only emerged at the same time, namely in the Reformation. In other words, all of the things that were good for Western civilization weren't to be credited to the Renaissance, but to the Reformation, which I agree with that so far, but they only emerged with the Reformation. The writings of Francis Schaeffer really popularized this view among evangelicals a generation ago. True thesis, but blown out of proportion. The other extreme is to react to that oversimplification by giving us another, and demand that all of the elements of this properly Christian humanism existed in full bloom in the Middle Ages and are to be credited to the Catholic vision. And this is being pushed today by sociologist Rodney Stark. Both views are too simplistic. Stark is right to defend the triumph of the Word that was there from the beginning of church history and grew increasingly bright in spite of the pagan darkness pressing in. But Schaeffer was also right to point to the liberation of the Word of God at the Reformation, which opened the floodgates to this power in a way that really had not previously happened before that event. But here's the point. The triumph of the Word is what is central. The triumph of the Word is ultimately neither a Catholic or Protestant phenomenon. It's ultimately a transcendent spiritual phenomenon which created the Catholic, lowercase c, and reforming occasions in ways that should not be ignored by any Christian. What stands behind these occasions of history ought to be our basic object of study, toward which the historical subject matter functions as a fitting lens. So when you are reading church history, don't forget that you're reading history. It is a theological history, but sometimes the history can function as an optical illusion, so that you do not fall in love with the occasions of the Word showing up. So, in history, we'll see that things overlap each other, and the cause of something can be a material cause and an ultimate cause, and as it turns out, this was really caused way back here and finds its roots, and you have all these complexities going this way, and you really start to... So, if I ask you, when did things go down the toilet in America? Oh, the 1960s. And somebody else will say, no, is it World War I at this time? Or no, somebody will say, no, is it Reconstruction? And something like that. And as you study it more and more, you realize that those views are really too simple. It's more complex than that. What you see ultimately in history, by the way, here's a clue. What you see ultimately in history is the triumph of the Word. What does Isaiah 55 say about the Word? Like the rain falls down from the heavens and it produces a crop, so will my Word go out. It'll never return to me void, but it'll accomplish that for which I send it out to do. Okay? What does that cover? It covers everything. God's Word alone creates everything. And all the more so, the things that emanate from the church, from Christian influence. So keep that in mind as you study. The basic object of our study is the Word of God creating every good thing in a historical timeline filled with a lot of bad things. What was everyday life like in the year 1000? We're going to do a little feudalism 101. An idiot's guide to feudalism. And I'm in there. You know, who cares about feudalism? What a boring, that's why we don't like the medieval stuff. In fact, as you listen to all this stuff. It's like, it's like a who's who in historical dupes, people that are just comical, abusive. It's the whole thing's unattractive, so we don't look at it. We don't study it. Well, by this time, tithes were essentially translated to taxes to the landowners in the system that history recognizes as feudalism. And you'll have in your notes a chart with a lot of these terms. By the way, this comes... from the Latin word... probably spelled that wrong anyway, sure enough. But sometimes, depending on which form it is, but it, you may not remember this from the first week of covenant theology, but that's the identical word that was used for covenants at this period, and which is why covenant theology oftentimes is called federal theology, and why certain systems of governments that have mutual obligations are called federal forms or federalism and stuff like that. So this word comes from the same Latin root as federal, which also issues forth into the noun used at the time for the basic material body of land and its people, namely the fief or fiefdom. Not fiefdom, although you may think it's that. And all of these are going to have a very specific connotation. They're not going to be really, really hard synonyms. They're all going to mean something very specific. And incidentally, this is where we derive the English word fee, or the pledge that was called for in their day, called fealty. So that's another word that's going to come up here. Pledging fealty to some particular authority over you, whether it's in church or state. So this is akin to the concept of covenant. The subject is vaguely familiar to us from a few otherwise forgettable weeks in 8th grade history class, but we're going to need to brush up on the system's multitude of foreign concepts that are attached to these words. First of all, what was meant by the fief or the fee that was so feudal or covenantal? What was the nature of the obligation, and what was its roots? We're going to see that its essence is something that stands in between the Roman and Christian concepts. There was a late Roman form of this, but it does not depend ultimately on rights. In fact, you asked the question, Joe, about John of Salisbury and when people are right. I don't want to exaggerate and say there was an enormous amount of political reflection going on in the Middle Ages that was very modern. But I would say that there's a surprising amount of us to modernists and maybe even evangelicals. There's a surprising amount of political reflection going on in the early Middle Ages that was, you would think, advanced. Especially, the Catholic Church. Which comedian says it? I think it was Dennis Miller. It was either him or George Carlin. Somebody being cynical about how the right politically criticizes the state for telling everybody else. So our argument is, the state shouldn't do this, the state shouldn't do that, the state shouldn't do this. That's organized religion's job. And so their point is that we're being hypocritical. Now, the Roman Catholic Church does put themselves in that position a lot. The Roman Catholic Church is saying a lot of things in the Middle Ages and their best thinkers that are very politically liberal. If you're cynical, you'll finish that sentence by saying, so that they can do that instead, or because the state's cutting in on their action. Well, there is a truth to that. Nevertheless, their argument is rooted in real biblical categories. Okay? So we're going to see this with feudalism, and we're going to see a difference between its serfs and the way we would recognize slaves. I don't know how else to draw this. I'm not suggesting that this is, but I'm thinking football field. Here's the top. Here's one end zone over here. Here's the bottom. I'm only doing it this way, so there's a top and a bottom. So you get that in your mind. I'm going to put a castle up here. I'm not really a castle drawer. But, you got that little thingy on top, that little hat, Well, it's got a moat. Yep, moats are real. All right. Okay, and so these are going to represent these houses and then plots of land and so on. Okay? So I'm drawing it this way so I can show you exactly what each of these terms are. First of all, the Lord. The Lord is one who conquered land and allocated its resources. Now, the main Lord, of course, is the king. So in a sense, the same setup as what would happen with a tribal chieftain. So this is evolving from those Germanic tribes and the Franks all the way to this time, where you had the Lord I'll just put them at the top. I'm not going to address them in any particular thing. I'm just going to say that they're the person that you can owe the allocation of those resources to. The vassal is one who held a land in fealty, or for a fee. And there's going to be a hierarchy of vassals, which take on the other names that you'll see. So there's a mutual... I shouldn't have done that. Here, I'll do this with pink. A transaction going on of sorts, represented by that pink. One going from the vassal to the lord, and then the lord to the vassal. Now, understand that this circle is, in a sense, a transcendent obligation. An obligation that, in a sense, transcends. It's not like slavery, in an important sense. And you might cynically say, it's the same thing, or it can go to that. True, but just hang on. A fief is the fee consisting in military protection, taxes, or land labor, or all of the above. That's the fief. So the obligation, what they are going to give to the lord, is the fief, or the fealty. The fiefdom is the grant of the land itself. So I'm going to put this line that goes down from the lord to the vassal. The fiefdom, the grant. The manor is the total plot of land that was divided by this whole grant. So this whole perimeter here. The peasant was a land worker bound to the land because of his or her property. So I'm going to put below the vassal, there is a kind of social, I don't want to say upward mobility, because we wouldn't recognize it as that today, but I'll just put down here a serf instead of a peasant, because you'll see the distinction. There's a hierarchy. Now, by pledging this, or so if what you pledge was military service, you could become, I'm going to just draw a spear, that's all. You'll get the idea. They're soldiers, or what would be a knight. So the count, if you have this in your notes, you'll see this. The count is a nobler or a more propertied vassal, lord of lower vassals. So in this vassals, this set of people called vassals, you could be a count, which was more nobler than the lower vassals, and this relationship would exist between you and the count. Then there was the duke, a nobler still. Count, who was a nobler vassal, lord of lower nobles. So you see there's a hierarchy developing here. A benefice was a benefit bestowed either by church or the lord. So the church is going to be cut in on this action here. And an allied, by distinction, is a plot of land that is owned outright, not bestowed by any particular authority. How did all this come about? Well, war and its attending instability mixed with poverty created this feudal relationship. The lord gave the vassal and his property protection. And in exchange, that's key, there is a kind of free exchange going on here. In exchange, the vassal gave the lord his military manpower. So there is a kind of at least initial market principle at work here. But that was the only element of freedom involved. Military service was really the main advantage that the lord was after. The church would follow this secular trend as well. The parish system had already begun to replace the provincial system of church organization. You remember that the Roman Empire was divided into provinces, and it's very secular, even going all the way to the architecture, the basilica, and the cathedral. And all these different things were patterned after the Roman state. Well, there was all this instability from wave after wave of barbarian invasion. So the provincial system was not even intelligible anymore. And so you have these local tribes emerging that would step into this power vacuum in the church. So you had a parish system emerge because the Catholics still wanted to extend their grip, and so this was the new form of that. Barbarian invasion, I already said that. Something had to replace this, but the old words were pretty much retained. The big difference now in how the Catholics try to control things through parishes rather than provinces was that the clergy had formerly been decentralized in the cathedral cities. The lords could now decentralize them with their money, and each secular lord would have their own parish priest. So even though Rome was supposed, so let me draw one more thing, a church. Even though Rome would send a priest, the priest answered to the lord of the manor. So the parish system, guess who's going to control the flow of theology? As much as Rome wants to. So eventually what's going to happen is that Rome is going to get in a struggle against feudalism. They're going to be incompatible. This would make it very difficult for any priest to maintain an independent prophetic ministry over and above the will of his Lord. But the church would also play a role of Lord. In other words, landlord. The state would frequently give monetary and real estate gifts to the church, which made it the most propertied entity in Western Europe. By the time of the Carolingian dynasty that we looked at last week, the church owned a third of all Frankish land. And that would become a major source of tension in the French Revolution, centuries later. The trouble with this property church is that people often neglect is that it was already secular as a result of its mostly extinguished states following the second wave of barbarian invasions. England had been invaded by the Saxons and then the Vikings, and these people groups were not as culturally subdued as they would become on the continent. By the way, I think that was an advantage in English Christianity. Not only its geographic isolation, but the fact that essentially its earliest progenitors were barbarians who were isolated from the continent. And it gave, when the Bible reached them, it had less church entrenchments to work through to cultivate a kind of indigenous Christianity in Britain, even though Rome was there and stuff like that. So by the 10th century, the English monastery bore no spiritual resemblance whatsoever to the orders following that other Augustine of Canterbury and Columbanus, the other guy that evangelized Ireland. It wasn't much better than the French, and it seemed like Alcuin's reforms that he had done during Charlemagne's reign had never happened. So, 2 centuries later, the monastery is in an absolute mess. I'm not going to go into all these specifics about the poverty at that time and how they did their work on the manor, but just to say that this created a problem. This created the kind of Christianity that was there at that time. Each local village, whether in England or France or Germany, was like a commune where both economy and polity enjoyed a measure of freedom, only because anything more centralized was absolutely impossible at that time. There was not a regulated currency or anything like that. But like antiquity, freedom was something that... So this polis, this city, this community, experienced a high degree of freedom from centralized governments. But freedom meant the freedom of this group, freedom of the Lord. It was a relative freedom. There wasn't anything... Freedom, in other words, did not naturally start in their pagan minds from the individual. It wasn't something God gave directly to each individual. That was something that Christianity was slowly cultivating in their minds. And the average person couldn't reflect on anything different. There really wasn't any contact with anything beyond the village or the manor for the average person. There was only one little window into which light could flow from outside, and that was the church. The problem was, again, that this person was completely owned by this person and this institution. An ignorant clergy meant an ignorant class of serfs. Notice in your head you're thinking about something that happened centuries ago. No, it's happening right now. Let me repeat that. An ignorant clergy meant an ignorant class of serfs. And so an ignorant clergy was the key for the Lord's maintenance of power. Somebody, lots of people, institutions will always have a vested interest in stupid Christians. Who benefits from unintelligent communication in the church? Somebody does. Any time in church history where those who have a vested interest in an ignorant laity gain the upper hand, the church is in slavery to the secular culture. It's a plantation church. I talk about the plantation school system. This is what I mean. There's a plantation church here. Serfdom. Initially, the peasants were free, although poor. And it was the destitute that were made serfs. But as poverty and insecurity increased, so too did the numbers of those who were at this bottom end. And in principle, what distinguished slavery from serfdom was that slaves were simply threatened to obedient work. One could not even speak of legal obligations in slavery, since mere property is not obliged, but simply worked to death. There's a huge difference. By the way, I'm not saying, so serfdom's really okay. No, serfdom leads to slavery. So again, you want to avoid two extremes here. Serfdom while servile and undignified by comparison to modern liberal states, was defined by mutual obligations. It was within this system. Everyone from the top to the bottom was legally obligated to a set of responsibilities to each other. Now, those things favored those at the top naturally and abused those toward the bottom naturally. Yet feudalism had the flavor of emerging humanity. It was abusive, but their abuse was being watched, so to speak, by a growing idea. It's said that the very word slave passed out of common usage by the end of the first millennium. Critics of Christianity respond to that that's only because it was replaced by the same thing under another name, namely serfdom. Though this may have been the wish of the lords, some in the church fought hard to insist that serfs were made in the image of God and were therefore to be respected in their most basic human rights. In fact, the specific differences in personal human rights between chattel slaves and serfs were many. But it would be the opposite error to conclude that there's not a constant slippery slope back toward barbarism. Notice, for example, the title of one of our favorite books in the 20th century, The Road to Serfdom. The argument is not serfdom more advanced than slavery, therefore hard line between them. No, serfdom, I would say affluence, leads to serfdom and then to slavery. Okay, so there's a natural progression going on here. We're simply making the argument that when those in darkness are starting to see the light, it's not very helpful to look back at them 20 centuries or 5 centuries later and mock them for only seeing a little bit of light. Okay? There's a progression to these ideas. So here, on this point, a guy like Stark, in his books, refutes Marxist deconstructionist mythology only by giving you Catholic Romanticism. The idea is that the medieval idea is superior, and that's true as to one point. The medieval idea was superior, but it was not self-perpetuating. It was not a given. It depended, like everything else, on the triumph of the word. Against this elevated serfdom was a creeping serfdom, where the individual had no property rights beyond what was granted by their lord. In other words, if the church was not letting in the light, yes, serfdom would descend to slavery. Why? Well, in this creeping serfdom, the individual would increasingly have no property rights beyond what was granted by their lord. They could not leave the land without permission. All they had left was their life and the barely recognized right to marry, which a lot of lords didn't even recognize. As property went, so went their liberty to move and to exist. As the right to exist independently went, so too did the right to life. Feudalism, in other words, taught the West the hard lesson that life, liberty, and property function just like everything else in reality. It's all connected. Yet without the church's arguments, even the basic right to life would have been eradicated. The word divided serfdom from slavery. And it would go on to divide something greater from serfdom. It may surprise you that the English word slave, and most of its European cognates, for example, the Italian, let's see if I get this right, my foreign, schiavo, in French, I'm not even going to try, but it basically sounds like esclave. In Spanish, esclavo, all derived from the word Slav. You recognize that word? We've looked at it in the barbarian invasions. That describes that people group that resides on the frontiers of Eastern Europe and what would become Russia. Though they were enslaved to the degree to which they were conquered, on the other hand, this reminds us that economic realities as an extension of a dehumanizing worldview is what makes men into slaves and nothing else. Dehumanizing worldviews, using economics and political circumstance as their occasion, is what makes people slaves. Bad ideas kill people, and enslave at the very least. The Marxist view of slavery has shaped how we have tended to think about it. It's an economy, slavery is, in the hands of the ruling classes that makes slaves. And the more one's religion becomes a function of power, the more dehumanizing and probably racist one's form of slavery will be. Notice, for example, in the Marxist view, and deconstructionists in the last 40, 50 years will tell you that the kind of slavery practiced by modern English-speaking people was the worst kind of slavery because of its racial overtones, which were in turn created by a religion that was a prop for the powerful. Well, of course, every lie is a twisted truth. Nevertheless, a study of this period of feudalism begins to wear the Marxist fabric thin. There was one more natural way out of the manor, and that was to become a soldier. Since they were in high demand, with the borders always under attack, and these soldiers were called knights, originally from the Germanic necht and the Old English neat. Remember the knights who said neat? Sorry. That's not where it comes from. But basically, both words in the Germanic and the English, which was from the Germanic, have the connotations of servant boy. Okay, so that's what a knight was. But it was the way out of regular serfdom, because they really, really needed that. Again, more market forces liberating people, though they don't really tell you that part, even though it's right under their nose. So this might not be social mobility, upward social mobility, as we would recognize it today, but it drew the connection between peasant and king, and between the people of the soul and the people group that was to be defended. All of this would have to be given a theological justification, and it was easier for the priest to provide this party line and save his own skin than to revolt against it. So the basic hierarchy of feudalism, last point on feudalism, is summed well by an author of medieval history. He said, the simple knight who had just enough land and peasant labor to support him and his family was the vassal of a larger landholder, who in turn would be the vassal of a still mightier man, perhaps of a count. The count might be the vassal of a greater count, of a duke, or of the king. In short, a great pyramid was formed with the king at the top and the ordinary knight at the bottom. So what you're going to see here is something that emerges that is abusive, and it's like Roman power in a sense, but the Roman Catholic Church sees this as a great enemy. So that's important to know, not because they had wonderful motivations in deconstructing it and showing some superior way of doing religion and doing economics or anything like that, but it's still important to know to destroy certain myths. There's not much else to say about feudalism at this time, but we're pretty much brings us right to the turn of the millennium. So as we get to our next session, just remember that everything we're really saying covers a period that spans for three centuries, what's often called the High Middle Ages. So that gives you a clue as to the relationship between feudalism and the church. It got things started and organized the church in some ways, and it became the enemy of the church. So it sort of stands at those crossroads. So let me open it up to questions before we get to our next session.